Today is Sunday, October 24th, 2021. This is part 22 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Jim Haggart, last name spelled H-A-G-G-A-R-T. My name is Tom Martin. Good afternoon, Jim. How are you?
I'm doing fine, Tom. How are you?
Great. It's good to carry on this oral history series after a month and some weeks of delay. But here we are. Last time, you left us off with a wonderful hike in the spring of 2006, and you didn't do any hiking in the fall of 2006, but in the spring of 2007, you were back on the trail. Where did you go in 2007?
Yeah, so it was a long drought, right, for sure. That's a whole year, but it's not nearly as bad as it's been in under COVID, you know. It's been 2 years now since I was in the canyon. But, in 2007, in March, we decided to just take a leisurely hike, really, and just in Marble Canyon, just to experience what it was, you know, what the delights are there. And it started out, well, was a three-person trip. This was with Art and Christensen and Bruce Grubbs. And the plan was to walk basically around Tadahatsell Point, you know. Now, this is where the tramway, one of the tramways, came down from the from the East Rim to the top of the Red Wall to that was done, I set up, I guess, in the 20s when they were scoping out potential dam sites in Marble Canyon. And we knew that we'd be, you know, passing next to that, so that was kind of a special attraction. And plus, I, you know, Art and Bruce hadn't really done any hiking in Marble Canyon ever. And I had done a fair amount in the 70s, mid-70s. And but not since 1988 had I been into Marble, and that was actually in the stretch from on the west side of Marble, from opposite Tadahatsell. There's a way to get down into the canyon there, and then down to Buck Farm Canyon. So that was a couple day loop that I did with a friend back in 88. So this would have been, you know, this new trip in 2007 was going to be kind of in that same country, and I was kind of really looking forward to seeing what it looked like from the other side of the river, right? And I'll give you more insight into that in a little while when we get to it. But I went down to Phoenix and met Art, and we went up to Flagstaff in that afternoon and stayed there with Bruce and Duart Martin, our good friends there in Flagstaff. And then the next day, not too early, we got up and headed north, the three of us, up 89A towards Cedar Ridge. And, you know, you take the road there, it heads off to the west at Cedar Ridge. And, you know, every time I drive that road, I get kind of fooled, because as soon as you leave the highway, you think, oh, well, we're heading west towards the Grand Canyon and we should be able to see it. But you don't,
right?
And because of the topography, you know, the land is rising to the west there, and so you spend the first 10 miles or so just slowly increasing, climbing up to the west, and then eventually you get to the height of land, and you can see across the plateau, the Marble platform, over to the Kaibab Plateau. And you know, it's always, every time I've taken that road in there, I've forgotten how spectacular it is to come up to the crest of the height of land there and look across and see the plateau, Kaibab Plateau, because,
yeah,
you know, you see pretty much the entire length of it from House Rock Valley all the way down to Cape Royal.
Mm-hmm.
And and at this time, I remember it was very, very snow-covered, so it was, you know, even more gorgeous with that white snow everywhere. So anyways, we followed the roads out, and I remember at this time we were following the STEC loops information, you know.
Okay.
STEC wrote loops and loops too, so this was not, you know, this trip we were taking was not by any means anything that, you know, had any sort of uncertainties in it. We knew that the route went every step of the way, basically.
Mm-hmm.
We just wanted to see what it was like ourselves and actually set foot in Marble Canyon. Like I say, I hadn't been there for nearly 30 years, so it was kind of exciting to get back there. And so we drove out the road, which is pretty good road that goes out to the tramway site on the rim. And of course, about a few miles short of the rim, at the short of the end of the road, you you drop down. The road drops down what's called the Eminence Break, which is a fault scarp and a major fault that passes through this part of Marble Canyon. It's the same fault that's responsible for the Sassy-Nasquet Butte that we talked about a couple, you know, 15 episodes ago or something like that, and which I attempted previously with Bruce and Tom Murphy, and then of course that fault continues across the Colorado River at mile 49.9, right? And and then so it's a big feature, and when the road that's going across the plateau reaches it, it drops quite dramatically down in a big switchback across the face of this this fault. So we parked our car right where that road makes the big bend to start to drop down the fault scarp. And because we were going to head north there about a half a mile to get into the drainage of Tatahatso Canyon. And so we parked around 10:30 or so and put on our packs and then headed to the northwest. And it starts out quite innocuously. It's just a little, you know, wandering drainage across the plateau with the sage there and pretty dry. And then all of a sudden it starts to drop into the Kaibab, right? And keep in mind, again, where you're basically walking along a fault trace in this gully, in this creek bottom. And so eventually it gets more pronounced. The topographic drop is more pronounced, and you have to search around for ways to get through. Now, we saw footprints there, so there had been people through there quite recently when we went in 2007. So again, this is, I think, because of Steck's book, it probably gets a fair amount of traffic. Although having said that, once we got below the Coconino here in Tatahatso, we saw relatively little evidence of people, so that was pretty interesting. But maybe somebody was just exploring the entrance to the drainage. I don't know.
It could be.
But eventually you get down, and it's pretty impressive because virtually the whole Kaibab is dropped down on the west side of this fault, right? So you actually have to down climb. You down climb the Kaibab and part of the Coconino right near the head of Tatahatso, and then you're basically through the Coconino, and you go downstream, and you're back into the Coconino again because you're on the other side of the fault, and it's dropped down quite dramatically. So, you know, it's kind of like you got to deal with getting through this stratigraphy twice, you know, on the same leg, but. It's fairly straightforward, and you know, the second when you're in the bed of Tatahatso and you encounter the Coconino a second time, it's relatively straightforward to find a route. I mean, it takes some looking around, and we've actually found two because Art found a route to the north of the bed that was much closer to the bed than the one that that Bruce and I followed, which required us to go even. To climb up higher and then go farther north and then come down and go back south to the bed to rejoin Art. So he found a quicker and easier route than we did. But the point is there's multiple ways to get through. So you just gotta poke around and look. And, you know, other than that, the hiking in there is quite easy and straightforward going down the bed of Tatahatso. Boulders here and there you gotta you know, jump across and be around and whatnot, but pretty nice and easy walking. And so we followed it down to the red wall, you know, where the red wall starts to crop out in the bed of Tatahatso. And we figured it was kind of like mid afternoon or 4 o'clock-ish, I guess, I'm not really sure, but we figured we might as well camp there because the next day we wanted to have a leisurely walk along the Redwall Rim to the south. And so we set our, you know, we found our campsites there and had a pretty nice little sleep on the Redwall.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the morning, we decided to not really split up, but Art and I decided to take a little side hike, and we wanted to hike up and go get and take a look at the Bridge of Sighs.
Okay.
And so, which is a couple of miles to the north of Tadahatsel. And so we, you know, we packed our day packs, just our fanny packs with some water and some food, and then started off. And Bruce basically sat there and was writing and taking his time, and he was going to relax. And then when he got ready, he would proceed south along the Redwall Rim. And eventually, Art and I would catch up to him. So,
okay.
Art and I headed north, and you know, the first thing we encountered, which was really cool to me, was there's a huge rock fall on the east side, on the east rim, and just north of Tadahatsel. And I had actually seen this in '88 when I was on the opposite side of the river, and I was at that when I was on that hike. It was after a Geological Society of America meeting, which had been held in Las Vegas. And so it was kind of, for me, it was kind of interesting because I'd just been to this geological meeting, and then I see this tremendous rockfall that had happened on the east rim of Marble Canyon.
Did
right?
it make
and,
it to the river?
Well, that's what I'm going to talk about a little bit here.
Hmm.
And so, you know, I couldn't really get a grasp from the west side of the extent of it, right? I could see that where it had calved off the rim,
okay.
from the in the Kaibab, and you could see that where, you know, there was slide debris, but down below on the slopes, but couldn't really get any more detailed information. But when we came through in 2007, it was much. We were actually walking right through it, and it turns out that this slide debris and the actual scar on the rim is probably, I'm just thinking back here, you know, over the years in my mind, it's probably 200 meters in length. You know, that much of the of the cliff fell out, 200 meters of from north to south.
Okay.
Of the Kaibab, the entire Kaibab just fell off, right? And and then, of course, below it, there's all this boulders and debris. And it turns out, when we walk through this area, of course, by this time, this was in 2007 now, there had been a lot of vegetation that had covered the debris, the detritus, right?
Okay.
And small bushes and stuff like that. In 88, I think that slide would have been much fresher. I think it was only a couple years old at that point. And, you know, there would have been much more exposed angular detritus and blocks and whatnot. But by this time in 2007, there was grass growing in there and whatnot. So, but you could still make out, this was so neat, you could still make out where the slide had come down, the slide debris, and you know, it had kind of accumulated in a drainage that had at the bottom, right at the Redwall Rim, there were like three or four notches in the rim where this drainage kind of fanned out, and little tributary drainages or subsidiary drainages kind of cut through the Redwall and dropped over the edge. And what had happened was, it appeared to me. Now, I'm not a geomorphologist. I was just looking at the evidence in here and making a geological interpretation. But but it appeared to me that this debris came racing down in this drainage, and basically hit it. When it encountered the Redwall, of course, there was like it was like a dam of that only had a few points that were breached.
Okay.
And so what happened is that all this debris kind of pooled.
Huh.
It dammed up behind this Redwall face.
Okay.
And then the debris kind of pooled there. So you could see actual, you can see actual stratigraphy in this feature on the red wall surface there. And it was so cool to see this and up close, you know, because you could just imagine all this torrent of material coming down and, you know, rush and then encountering the lowland area at the red wall rim and then damming up, right? And then and then some of it being able to pour over. So I'm sure some of it went over down into the river below.
Okay.
And it would be something, it would be neat for you guys who are on the river to actually look at that and, you know, the below the red wall at that spot,
right,
and see if there's any sort of, you know, boulder piles and whatnot. There must be.
Yeah, see if
I
you could
think.
Figure out a mileage. It'd be interesting to look.
Yeah, I can do that. Well, I'll do that after this okay. session here, and I'll send that to you.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
And I can maybe send you my photos, too. So
okay.
I got a few photos of that.
Okay.
So, anyways, that was pretty neat, I thought. You know,
so
and
as you guys are hiking up river along the top of the red wall, before you get to the Bridge of Sighs, you're going to have to cross the 36-mile drainage.
Okay, yeah. I'm not sure exactly which one that is, but there
it's
is...
a fairly large drainage, of course, coming
yeah.
in from the east. And I just kind of wondered what that was like. Because of often, from the river, when you look up there, you can kind of see through little breaks in the red wall that there might be routes that go all the way up to the rim there.
Okay, that's the next thing I was going to talk about. was that, you know, as we continued north, we did cross that drainage, although I, you know, because I'm not river centric,
right?
I don't keep track of the mileages along the river,
uh-huh.
except for classic places like 49.9 or something
yeah.
like that.
Yeah.
You know, where hiking intersects the river, right? And so, but I know that 36.6 must be this drainage because yes, I thought the same thing from above. You know, hiking the Red Wall Rim, looking
right.
up,
right.
I can never say 100% convinced, but like 90 to 95% convinced that one can get through
okay.
there to the rim.
Hmm.
We didn't have time to try it because we had to get back and meet Bruce
right.
and then continue south.
Right.
But it certainly would be a great thing to try. Now, when we went to down, so we continued north. We crossed that drainage and continued north, and eventually we got to the area of the Bridge of Sighs, and, you know, there's river runner trails in there.
Yeah.
So we didn't find them initially, but we were able to, you know, eventually work our way down through the red wall and picked up these trails and then worked our way right down to the river.
Okay.
And it's just a spectacular spot.
Yeah.
I have to say, I want to read what I wrote here because in my notes because it was just funny how I described this. I'm sorry here. I should have underlined this, but yes, there are the standard extraordinary views. So I mean, kind of a understated thing, but really, you know, it is an extraordinary area of the Grand Canyon to be able to hike into
yeah.
because you're in the middle of the red wall, right, stratigraphically, and maybe a little bit lower than that, but it just soars up above you on both sides of the river, and you have these, you know, we are on this little bench of strata that we could clamber down to, and you have this green, quiet river just murmuring by, and all this red rock, and then of course the sliver of blue above, and it's just really phenomenal place to be able to hike to, you know, and at least for me,
yeah.
you know, that's kind of the way I deal with these things, react to these things, and so it was really, really, really cool to get down there with Art and just kind of sit there and listen to the silence, and all you hear is just the occasional, you know, murmur out of the river when a whirlpool or an eddy comes up and something like that, you know, we just sat there and washed our feet and just chatted and had a great time, and nobody went by, no boats, you know,
mm-hmm.
so we were I shouldn't say fortunate, but, you know, in, if one is expecting and hoping to get solitude, you know, then maybe you don't want a boat to go by.
That's right.
But I mean, we always enjoyed interacting with river runners, don't get me wrong.
But it's March, and so there's, you know, maybe a trip a day.
Yeah, and we didn't spend 4 hours there. You know, we only spent 30 minutes or something like that, right, relaxing on the river. So, but when we headed up, so this gets back to 36.6, when we climbed back up, we found this river runner trail. I'm assuming it's a river runner trail. I mean, maybe it was just sheep or deer. I don't know.
It could be from the late 40s, early 50s dam site construction to get water. But I know they also brought in water on the tramway in big tanks.
Okay.
So I'm not quite sure on that trail.
Yeah, that's interesting. Okay, so... It's good to talk to you about this because I kind of thought you know you river runners would have all this scoped out, but when we went back up, we climbed back up higher into the red wall to go back up to the red wall rim, and we found this trail heading south about halfway up to where to the rim, right, to where we came down from, and so we hiked south on this trail, and. And at one point, I left Art and I walked out onto a little point so I could look down onto the confluence of 36.6 and the river. I could look down in that area, and I thought that I might be able to work my way down in that area, right in that creek, right in that drainage. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's the case, but certainly by connecting. The way we came up from this break, and then you walk over to the drainage of 36.6, it would be a very direct route to the rim, and certainly worth checking out. I figured you and your cronies would have been all over that.
Yeah, no. There are some dry falls in there, so you don't get far coming up from below, but... From the Bridge of Sighs, there is a way above 36 Mile to get out in there, and it's faulted in there, so there's a way to get out up through the lines, up through the Red Wall. And the pack rafters are in there working that over, but this was 2007, so that's a while back now, so.
Yeah, well, I had walked across, you know, the Bridge of Sighs in 88 and not even realized... that when I say across it, I meant above it, right? And not even realize it was there because I don't remember why, you know, at that time I didn't appreciate that there was the feature existed.
That it was even there, it's easy to walk right by.
Yeah, but I do remember all sorts of pinnacles and complex topography in there, in that part of the canyon. So, anyways, it was just very, very cool little, you know, 3-hour side hike that we took here. And with a lot of interesting geology and a lot of opportunity for additional hiking, you know, it just never ends, does it? So, I think I would love to be able to go up there and hike up 36.6 and up to those breaks that look like they're going to go, and then you just find some Moki steps, you know, right at the critical spot.
Yeah.
Wouldn't something like that be spectacular to run into?
I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, there is a route, well-known Puebloan route. At the Bridge of Sighs, there is a Puebloan structure on the east side of the river, and the bridge, with its actual woodwork and stone rock placement, is on the west side. So there is a route there.
Okay.
You have to swim across the river, you know, or boat across the river. However, they worked it out.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that's a route there. It's a trans-Canyon route.
And so on the west side. Where I came down was a drainage about 30, about 40, 36.9 or 40, or 37.1 or something like that. That's the drainage that came down. I forget, it doesn't have a name, and I forget.
So when you say 36.6, I think of... it's just downstream from the Bridge of Sighs.
Right.
And there's a camp on a little bit, a little postage stamp sized chunk of Esplanade called Camp Starship. And there's a water hole there, but there's also water in the top of the red wall and some pretty deep holes.
Yeah, right.
Which is, and again, I'm thinking of that as 36.6. And the actual 36-mile rapid is upstream of there. It is kind of between that drainage on the west side, because the 36-mile rapid drainage is coming in from the east.
Yeah.
And upstream of that rapid at 36-mile is a bridge of size. So that kind of puts that area kind of together.
Yeah, okay. Okay, well, anyways, it's interesting to learn that there's all this additional, ethnological data information in there.
Yeah.
It would be a great place to go hang out for a couple of days if you had a boat. You could
cross the river. We'll
cross the river.
Just cross the river. You bet.
Yeah, check it out. So, something to do in my old age, right?
Uh huh.
So, okay. Well, so we had to get back south, and we backtracked and went then and headed back south to Tatahatso Canyon. And when we got to when we got to the drainage, we could look across and we could actually see Bruce on the other side of the drainage.
Oh, wow.
He packed up his gear and was heading heading out, right?
Okay.
And
yep.
so we went back into the head of the drainage at the red wall there and grabbed our gear and then followed him out and eventually caught up with him. And the walking there is just, you must have been up there. You must have hiked up there sometime.
Not on that side, but on the other side.
Well, you are just walking literally inches from the 500-foot drop, and it's like a sidewalk. It is just like it's been manicured. It's almost like these bridge surveyors had their student assistants go in there with rakes and clean this off for future hikers. It's just such an easy place to walk. And so you're looking down quite literally, 500 feet, and a couple times we actually threw rocks into the river, right, from the Red Wall Rim, small rocks, and we could see them hit the river. And
wow.
So it was it was very impressive, because that shows you how close you actually are, geographically to the river. Now, topographically, you're way up above it, but it was very impressive. And so we just hiked along that, just taking our time, because there's so much to see. And eventually, as you hike south and actually more like west, the Supai Talus starts to close in on you.
Yep.
And so the Red Wall Rim starts to get littered with Supai boulders, and then eventually the topography comes in so that you're kind of like, I won't say side-hilling, but, that wide, flat terrace has kind of disappeared. And it takes time to walk through the boulders of the Supai and whatnot. And nothing complicated, but, it is an interruption of that very straightforward sidewalk-type hiking. So we followed that around until we got to just north of the tramway site, and we figured that this would be a good place to stop for the afternoon. We were in no rush. We wanted to take it easy, but we did stop right where the terrace started to open up again, right?
Okay.
And so we could see ahead. By this time, we'd turn to the south, and we were going to start the stretch that heads down towards the tram.
Yep.
And we could see that it was going to open up and be flat walking again, easy walking. We thought, well, let's just camp here and relax, and we'll get a nice start in the morning tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
So we did that. And then the next day, we got up and headed down. And again, as I said, the walking is just so friendly and relaxing. And when we got to the tramway site, it was pretty neat to poke around there. I'm sure that a lot of that detritus has been removed over the years by Park Service, but we found a fair amount of stuff,
mm-hmm.
Sighting tripods and tent frames and things, tent platforms, I should say, not frames. Yeah, and you know, lots of garbage, and but nothing you know, really obtrusive.
That
of course,
place
you know,
got reworked and recamped and visited in the '60s by the Arizona Power Authority when they wanted to put in the Marble Canyon Dam there. Reclamation, Reclamation had already come in and done their survey work in 4950, and I think that was the longest tramway of its kind in the world at the time when they had the thing set up.
Oh, wow.
They went down to the marble platform there from the rim, and then there was another tramway that went from the rim down to the river.
Huh, okay. Yeah. Yeah, okay, that's kind of neat. And so they would go down in a bucket down to the river then, huh?
Yeah.
Oh, cool. Cool. Wow. Yeah. And you guys, I mean, there's no way to get up there. I mean, technically climbing up, I shouldn't say technically climbing, but, you know, there's no kind of third-class route that comes up from the river.
Oh, no.
No. Uh-uh. I didn't think so.
No, it's sheer.
Yeah, from my understanding, there's no route to the river from this route that Art and I used to get down opposite Bridges Size until you get to President Harding. But there
that's
may
right.
be something
that,
right
I,
at 36.
I
yeah, okay, good. We're on the same wavelength then, so. But again, you know, you never know what the people coming up from below have found.
That's right. That's right.
So it's always great to talk with you about
this. Every now and then I'll run into somebody that says, oh, yeah, well, back in the 80s, there was a rope come down a cliff, and you could pull yourself with that rope if you were willing, and then there was a little trail, and you could go, and I'm like, really? Well, I don't know. I've never seen that, but
yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, well, so
lots of junk.
Yeah, lots of junk, and you know, you can kind of imagine what's there, but I guess, you know, thinking about it, this is not something that river runners see typically, is it? Because
well,
they
don't
so
see
far,
it at all. River runners don't see it at all. What's on top of the red wall? They see the stuff below.
Yeah, but you guys often will do side hikes, right? You do loops off the river and whatnot, you know, like the Carbon Creek loop and things
like that. But to get to that tramway site, you have to either come in from the Bridge of Sighs at 36 Mile or come in from Eminence. And either way, it's really too far to go in a day out and back.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Yeah, I take your point on that. And you know, I mean, quite honestly, it's pretty virgin in there. You know, we did not, there's no worn path or anything like that until we got down to Eminence Break. And,
right.
And so... It was very, very fun to walk in there. Like I say, so easy, you know. If people knew, if the average hiker knew how easy it was to hike in this part of the world, there'd be thousands of people in there.
Well, there are a number of people that do the Tadahatsu Eminence Loop. It's a well known loop now, anyway, in you know, 2021.
Yeah. Well, anyways, we had a great time there, and then we walked. We continued on past the tramway and followed the red wall rim. Again, it's all super easy walking, and then until you get in, as you're starting to head into the bigger drainages that come down off the south side of the Tadahatsu plateau, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a series of side drainages that come in before you get to the Eminence Break route drainage.
Right.
And you have to head those and before when we were doing that, when we got to the first one, the first major one, which comes it's basically the drainage that it's a major drainage that comes off the plateau there.
So just for quick clarity,
you
pass the camp and you hang a left and go around the corner, and there's a long straightaway that's kind of easy walking until you get to sort of the Eminence Break corner, if you will.
That's right. And so in that area, you essentially the supai recedes farther away from the red wall rim.
Okay.
And so you have more of a dissect, and the drainage is cut farther down into the redwall.
Right.
Okay. So you have a more dissected topography there.
Up and down. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's up and down, up and down, and I think, you know, my recollection is that Steck made some to do about this in his loops. You know, that it was challenging walking or something, and we slowed down, but it was, you know, by no means, you know, problematic or anything like that. You just take your time, and you know, the route is pretty obvious and whatnot. So, but before we got to the first of these major drainages, Art, Bruce, and I, this time Art stayed back with the packs, but I talked Bruce into going and walking out to the point overlooking the river.
Cool.
Because I wanted to look down on the Bridge of Poles. Okay.
Okay. Yep.
And I had never seen that, right?
Okay.
And so I thought this might be a good vantage point to see that. And so we walked out. There's only like 5 minutes or something like that to get out there. And you know, not knowing exactly where it was, I had to poke around for a while, looking, you know, through the extender lens on my camera, right?
Yeah, okay.
Because I don't think we had binoculars. But eventually we found this thing, right?
Cool.
And
you're looking
down
on it. Yeah.
Yeah, looking down on it from the opposite side of the river. And it was very impressive. You know, I could see. In fact, it's one of the pictures that pops up on my, you know, my display, computer display.
I'd love to
monitor.
See it. Yeah. Huh.
Yeah. And so it's not. It's kind of grainy because it's a very. I had to, you know, use my telephoto on the on the little handheld camera, and it's not the best picture, but it definitely gives you a sense of what it's like, right? And you know, and I guess I have to say that I've always been fascinated by this bridge because Harvey wrote about it in Trex, in one of his Trex books, and you know, I don't know the full history of exploration of this bridge. I know that, you know, Harvey had looked into it, and then Kenton Grau had
Grua, G-R-U-A, yeah.
Grua, okay. I've never, you know, been aware of how that should be pronounced.
Right.
Grua,
and Alan Tibbetts. So that was Grua and Tibbetts that went up there.
Yeah, that's right. And so I had heard these stories, right? And I think that actually Harvey says something in his treks about Grua and Tibbetts, but not the full details. And so what I had heard was that, you know, through the grapevine, talking to people and who had been talking to somebody in Flagstaff or whatever, you know, over the years, was that Grua and Tibbetts had found a route to the Redwall Rim after crossing the bridge. And this route involved going up chimneys and caves in the Redwall and eventually coming out, you know, on top of the Redwall. This is what I'd heard, and of course I was very interested to try and see if there was evidence for that from my vantage on the east side of the river, right?
Right.
And we could definitely see the bridge, but above that, you know, there was nothing obvious.
Right.
And you know, at that point I realized, well, if there's any truth to this story, then it obviously has to be kind of hidden inside the cliff, right? It has to be subterranean and some sort of a climbing route in caves, which, you know, is not. There are other routes like that, right?
That's right.
So this wouldn't be anything new. And quite honestly, I'm sitting here telling you this. I'm telling you my understanding in 2007, and my understanding hasn't improved any about this since that time. So after our trip in 2007, I actually wrote to Ellen Tibbetts. I got her address off the internet, and I wrote to her in Flagstaff a number of times to try and, you know, get some information about this, and I never heard back from her. So it was a little frustrating, but I guess, you know, it may have been something that she didn't want to remember, or who knows, you know, there could be all sorts of reasons,
yeah.
But she kept quiet about that, which I respect, you know, after writing a couple times, you know, you don't want to push it any farther. So,
right.
So yeah, I mean, at this point, you know, I still don't know whether there's a through route there or not. And so we actually continued then that afternoon. We headed those drainages, and you know, it's pretty interesting route finding. The trail from the break comes down high to the east, and we actually crossed the last of these major side drainages below the trail, and went down through the red wall some distance, and then climbed up a buttress on the south side of this drainage, and then proceeded to even farther south, and then encountered the trail coming down from the Eminence Break route above.
Right.
And so, you know, it kind of reminded me of the area in along the Butte Fault, down around Char Butte and Temple Butte. You know, just the way the red wall there is preserved, and you can kind of walk down or climb down these ramps and buttresses, and then you across the drainage, and then you can see the climbing route up the other side. You know, but that's the way we did it, and we joined the trail there, and then followed it down to the river, and spent the night there. Now, before we went to bed, Art and I hiked upriver to get a view of the Bridge of Poles from below.
Right? Okay.
To see what we could see, and it was pretty tough going because of the willows. I remember, you know, we had to really kind of, you know, wade here and there.
It is thick in there.
Yeah, definitely.
Above present Harding Rapid, it's a good little jungle in there.
Yeah. So we did hike up about a mile and a half or something like that.
For
so
you
we
guys.
We could look across at the bridge from below, right?
Yeah.
And you could see it, right? And we could also see the red wall cliffs that one would have to climb before you reach the bridge.
Right.
And so it was kind of neat, you know, to see it from both above and below, you know. And but it was kind of late in the day at that point, so we had to beat it back to our campsite. And there were river runners there, for sure. They went through in the afternoon, and everybody was waving back and forth, you know. So, so we had a good night there, and then the next day, of course, we just followed the standard route out the Eminence Break route. And I do have to say that the Red Wall descent, I remember it being, because the first time we did it, of course, we came down from above, like pretty much everybody would, I guess, except river runners. And it was very complicated. And I remember, I actually wrote in my notes, is my compliments, you know, I tip my hat to whoever found this route, you know, from at the first. Well, obviously it was, you know, First Nations people.
Problem,
but,
yeah.
You know, from a hiking perspective, a modern hiker's perspective.
Right.
It might have been somebody named Joanna McComb from Southern Arizona, because I seem to remember in Harvey's Trex books that he credited her with finding that
did he really
that route.
Interesting.
Yeah, you might want to look into that. That's what I seem to recall.
Huh.
And Joanna McComb apparently was a pretty good climber, because she did some first ascents on Babel Kiveri.
She
was
McKinley. Yeah.
Oh, really?
She's an impressive. I had a chance to visit with her some years ago. Really wonderful woman. But before her, I would not be surprised if the dam guys might have gone up there from 4950. Their camp was in Burt's Canyon, halfway between the dam site and present Harding. We're a little closer to the dam site than Harding, but downstream was, they had a motorboat. Motorboats came down there in 49, and so they would have definitely gone down to the top of present Harding anyway if they wanted to.
Yeah.
Did they actually climb up there? I don't know. But they would have been all over that area doing their dam work.
Yeah, you're right. That's a very good point. And it makes a lot of sense. So, I could see that happening. And, of course, as you also point out, from the tramway campsite on the Red Wall Rim, you know, this is the first place you can get down to the river on the east side.
Right.
So anybody who, you know, was maybe on their day off, you know, would head said, "Well, I think I'll hike down to the south and see where we see where we can go." They might, you know, might have encountered it that way too. So yeah, there's all sorts of options. We'll never know the truth there, but you know, still, it's a fairly a very neat route. I just think it's a very neat route.
And the Southern Arizona Hiking Club with John McComb, Joanna's husband, John and Joanna, and Eber Glenn Denning, Eberglending, those folks were in there in the 60s and 70s. Were they in their 60s? I'd have to look. Definitely in the 70s.
I think it might have been 60s because Harvey wrote about it in, well, like, I guess his second treks would have been mid-70s, right? So, it could have been very early on, right?
Yeah.
So I got the sense it was like the generation before me, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Yeah. And Joanna could have been very well the first documented female.
Yeah, very cool. So, but I remember when we came up that drainage, you know, it's just a very fun route.
Yeah.
I mean, it's very secure all the way, but steep, you know. And I remember you come up, at least the way we came up, right at the rim, we walked under a portal.
Yes.
And, you know, it's like coming back to the world of the Hopi, right, and Navajo. And
this is this giant boulder that is wedged in this chute, basically, and you go right under the thing.
Yeah.
And you can walk out on it if you want, but it's like angle of repose right up to the rim. It's just super steep. Up, and then there's this giant boulder, and you go under it, and then you pop up on the rim.
On
the flat. You're out of the canyon, and the view. Wow, it's stunning up there.
Oh yeah, spectacular place to be. So, yeah, so that was a great little trip, you know,
Your car at that point is north of you. Is that right?
Yeah, so the car is like a mile. It's not very far,
But the Tadahatsu Road going out to the tramway camp goes right past the top of the Eminence route.
Yeah, for sure.
So you just hop out on the road and start. You just leave your packs and just send. You know, you or Bruce or Art up there to get the car. Did you all walk up there?
No, we all walked up there.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we all walked up to it together. So.
Cool. Oh, fun.
Yeah. I don't know why. I don't know why I didn't think about sending him up to get it.
Go get the car. You got to come back this way anyway. We'll sit here and wait for you.
Yeah.
We'll draw straws. Here, I'll let you choose.
Right. So, yeah. So that was a great little hike in March of 2007, and we actually did a second hike a couple days later, another short one. I don't know if you want to talk about it now, but we finally got to Tyndall Dome.
Okay, let's do it.
Okay, and so there's not a whole lot to say about this because, you know, I think you may recall that Art and I had attempted Tyndall Dome in Wallace, 2000, and in March of 2000, and we were very intimidated, to say the least, by Tyndall, the red wall descent, to go down to it, and then we backed off Wallace at the same time, right? So we kind of had for me it's like I got to get back there and get this done, you know. I got to figure this out, and Art's always very keen to go along on any kind of a jaunt like that. So we thought, you know, by this time the sufficient years had gone by that we had forgotten the difficulties. So we had our confidence back up, and so we thought we would bring some ropes this time, and some, you know, protection, like a rack of gear, small rack to try and protect Wallace if we needed to, and we'd try both these peaks, right? So the three of us headed out again, Bruce and Art and myself, on the 10th. So this was like the day or two after we ended the Eminence Break trip. And
10th of March or into April now?
No, this was in March.
Okay.
March 10th, yeah. And we drove out. We kind of left Flagstaff late because we were in no rush, and we drove out the out to Pastor Wash and parked the car there and started down. And we had found Art and I had found a nice break that gets off Huxley Terrace pretty far out along the terrace. So the way we went down in 2000 was we went down the South Bass Trail. So you follow the Esplanade to the north. Well, you actually just follow the trail, right? And when you drop down the South Bass Trail, you drop down the first cliff there through the Esplanade.
Right.
And then the trail makes a big swing back to the south.
Yes.
And then slowly descends as it trends to the south over about a half a mile through a lot of the supai. But where it does that big bend, you know, Art and I had just gone straight down to the north in 2007. And, you know, obviously you wouldn't bring mules down there, but
right.
hikers, it was no problem. And when we came back on that day in 2007, we could see that there was another break even farther to the north on Huxley Terrace. So that was our destination. You know, we figured that's where we should drop off and start the trip. So we hiked out that far in the afternoon and camped there at the top of this break. And the three of us, we had found a great campsite there and just chatted and had a great evening. And then in the morning, Bruce he wasn't interested in doing any of the climbing. So he packed up his gear and went back over and I guess he day hiked out onto Grand Scenic Divide, which was pretty neat because he had great camera gear and he got some shots of us.
Oh, super.
Right? Yeah. And so so in the morning then, Bruce took off to the back to the south and then, you know, Art and I packed up our climbing gear and stashed our backpacking gear, and then dropped down this break and followed it around and basically down to the Red Wall Rim. So this is the Red Wall Rim on the west side of Bass Canyon below Huxley Terrace. And so it's easy walking up and down a little bit, but, you know, eventually you get out to Tyndall Dome. And before we got there, we were looking up at Wallace, and this time we were... a little bit. We had Tamazi's route description with us at that point, so we felt a little bit more confident because we had, we had some beta there, right?
And this is Aaron and Purnell Tomasi, Tomasi. That's the called the Tomasi brothers. They are the children of Wayne Tomasi, and all, that entire family, along with a sister and another brother, are all strong Grand Canyon hikers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. It's impressive what they've done, no question.
Yeah.
So, and the Tomasi children have put together a couple of guidebooks to Grand Canyon hiking, which are limited, but they do have some good information for select climbs.
Yep.
And Wallace is one of them. And so, cool. You know, there's a picture there, and the description seemed pretty innocuous, so we thought we'd be able to do this, and so we get to, but our first destination was to go to Tyndall, and you know we'd been out there in 2000 to look at this with no ropes because Alan Doty did Tyndall and Wallace in the same day without a rope. It's my understanding.
Yeah, but Alan Doty, you know, he makes the rest of us mere mortals remember we're mere mortals.
Yes. Yeah, well, I have such a high level of appreciation for Alan Doty's climbing skills, I have to say, and it's based on this Tyndall climb, let me tell you.
And that's Doty, isn't it?
It is, yeah,
okay.
Alan, I believe.
Okay.
And so, you know, we had scrambled around this in 2000 at the top, you know, trying to find a way down, and couldn't, and it's extremely exposed, you know, it's just like the whole Red Wall length, or a large part of it, maybe 400 feet, and it's, you know, a very, very steep drop, so we came back with a couple of ropes this time, and actually, it couldn't have been that long, because we did this in one rope, so maybe it was only 200 feet at the max. I'd have to talk it over with Art now, I guess, but it must be something closer to 200 feet. But still, the sense of vertical is really overwhelming, and So we actually fixed the rappel line, and we thought, well, what we'll do is we'll try and down climb it and use the line as a handheld,
okay,
you know, the support, or maybe we put a prussic on it. We had Jumars
right.
too, right?
Yeah, okay.
And so we were prepared for the whole, you know, for quite an epic if we had to be, and so we started down climbing it, and again, it was, you know, we tried two or three different options and chimneys and face climbing, and eventually I just said, well, you know, it's beyond my skill level, so I just rappelled.
Huh.
And so we actually rappelled, you know, like in three increments. I would go down and to a ledge, and then Art would come down, and then I went down to the next ledge, and you know, looking at the climbing, I actually kind of assessed it as like 5.6, 5.7.
Okay.
That's what I thought it would be if you were coming up from below, right?
Right.
So that Doty must have down climbed this free, and done Tyndall, and then, you know, once you've gone down it, it's no big deal to go up it. So
right.
very, very impressive, very spectacular, and so we didn't know it at the time, but while we're rappelling right on this red ridge crest, Bruce is over on Grand Scenic Divide to the south with his huge telephotos.
Sweet.
Taking pictures of this,
great.
You know. So that was very cool. You know, you can see us. We're not huge or anything like that, but it makes it even more impressive, right, because you see the whole North Rim behind it and everything. So you can see these little minuscule people going down the ridge, right?
Mm.
So once you get down to the base of the rappels, it's Tyndall's a very easy climb, right? You just it's third class scramble basically, and fun summit to be on, but and one could, I guess, come up from below and you know avoid the rappels that we did, or down climbing that Alan Doty did, but very fun. And there was no cairn when we went there, and we kind of thought there was very limited evidence that anybody, I'm sorry, there was no register, but there was a cairn.
Okay.
But there didn't, you know, there was, other than the cairn, there was no evidence that anybody had been there recently. So, you know, it felt almost like a virgin summit, you know, like very sparsely visited. So it was kind of neat to do that. And so then we went back, Jumard and free climbed and up the ropes, and free climbed where it was easy, and Jumard where Alan kind of had to look down and pause and consider his footsteps for a few moments, and we got back to the rim, and we were kind of beat after all this because it was kind of an adrenaline draining thing, but we figured, well, let's go try Wallace, you know. And so we went up to Wallace, and we knew from our 2000 experience that there was this secret chimney on the west side of Wallace that gets you up through the first Supai cliff. And so we headed for that. And once you're up above that chimney, then you can follow along on the ledge to the north, and then around the north tip of Wallace on the same ledge, and then you follow the same ledge to the south, and that's where the climbing route is.
Hmm.
And by the time we got to the base of the climbing, we were feeling pretty tuckered.
Okay.
And that's what I'm going to say, that we both were feeling pretty tired, and it was late in the day. And
yeah.
So we didn't have the time to do the climb. But in actuality, you know, I did poke around on the basal parts of the cliff, and I was thinking, you know, even with a rope on, I just don't feel like I've got it in me today, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Even with protection, I just don't feel like it's the right day to do this. And so, you know, Art felt the same way. And, you know, he's a bolder third classer than I am. And he didn't really want to have anything to do with this. And so we basically said, okay, you know, that's it. We're gonna be satisfied with one summit, right?
Cool.
So we backed off it again, and then we just retraced our steps and stayed high from Wallace. We stayed high following the Supai slopes till we meet, till we reached our break that took us up to Huxley Terrace. And then from there, went and hiked to the south, caught up with the Bass Trail, and eventually caught up with Bruce, and headed back to the car.
Cool.
And so an interesting, you know, aside here is that on the driving back, it was in the dark by the time we got, you know, to the rim and started to drive back to Flagstaff. And we actually ran into the Havasupai.
Okay.
At the gate.
At the boundary there. And so when you come in, the little camp was there, but there was nobody there.
There was nobody there, yeah.
Okay.
And so, and this is the first time we had ever run into anybody there. And they asked us for the $25, and we had it, and we gave it to them. And I mean, it was all very, you know, they were very cordial.
Mm-hmm.
That's my recollection.
Yep.
And they told us that all a great sum is, you know, off limits now.
Right.
And so we were a little chagrined to hear that. But because, you know, we spent a lot of time out there and would love to go back. But when I say great sum, of course, for your listeners, it just means the rim area.
Right.
And I guess my understanding is that at some point, at least, the Park Service was going to be in discussions with them about allowing access up there.
I think they still are. I mean, the legislation gives access rights on the deer trail. Of course, the rim, a quarter mile setback from the rim, is national park land with traditional use rights to the Havasupai.
Mm-hmm.
But the tribe looks at it as, no, it's closed. The deer trail is closed.
Yeah.
So to get out there anymore without using the deer trail is problematic for lack of water. But, you know, people are still doing it. They're still working on it. So.
Yeah. Well, I've been talking with Jake Daly about access to the Western Esplanade, you know, from Havasu.
Yeah.
And there are ways to get into there to
That's
the
right.
west side. But if you want to get into Fossil Bay, for instance, I mean, it's kind of awkward, you know.
You have to get down on the Esplanade, you know, either you know, work your way either from Ells Chasm, from coming in the standard Royal Arch route and staying low, or you try to come in on the Esplanade, which can be done. It's a long way, but it can be done.
Yeah.
Or you try to come around the rim, and however you do it, water is an issue to try to get to Fossil Bay.
Yeah, for sure. Well, hopefully that'll open up again for hikers at some point.
Yeah, it's important to realize the indigenous peoples got there first, and then the park showed up. So you know, if they say that it's closed, then it's like, okay, it's closed. But you know, if they close the deer trail, I think it's a lot easier for them to do. They can't close the rim of the park.
Yeah.
So that still allows some air.
Yeah.
But I know the Park Service is, you know, talking to the nation about that, and so we'll see what they do. Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, you and I talked about Specter. Chasm, and you know, and I mentioned that you know, I think there might be a possible route up from Specter to the rim at near Stanton Point. I'd like to check that out someday. And I
didn't find it at Stanton Point, but I did find it around the corner a ways. And you end up just doing the regular Tadahatso route. The key is to get from the Hermit, top of the Supai, down to the top of the Red Wall, because you can get through the Red Wall, but you do that down through the Supai quite a ways downstream from Spectra.
Oh, okay. Okay, so it's, well, anyways, we'll have to talk about this at a subsequent time.
That's
right. Yeah, so, but
cool.
The point is there's so much to be done out there, right? So,
oh, yeah.
and it's such a magical area, I find, that whole Esplanade. I fell in love with it, and 30 years ago when we started hiking there, I wish I could experience all that discovery all over again, you know, but at least we have memories.
That's right. Well, maybe with that, this is a good place to put a comma in this oral history series. and conclude part 22. Today is October 24th, 2021. This is our Grand Canyon Oral History interview series with Jim Haggart. And my name is Tom Martin. Jim, thank you so very much.
Well, thank you, Tom. I really appreciate the opportunity to relive all these great adventures.
Awesome. Well, thank you for doing it, and we will talk again.
Cheers.